You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is the Daily Nationalist Radio Albion for Thursday, the 30th of May, 2024. I just got off the phone with a friend of mine in Kiev. He told me that on the train ride from Poland to central Ukraine, that the train was just loaded with mercenaries, enemy mercenaries, suggesting that this is how the regime is going to continue this, if they continue this at all. As depressing as that is, we're not going to talk about that today. Actually, we're going to talk about something even more depressing, and that is the situation in Libya. As you know, I've dealt with this many times in the past. And I have a few pieces, one from the other day, and a couple from late last year, after the flooding. And the nature of the flooding actually is the political side of things. I have several papers out on this topic, because it really is an excellent case study, A, in how social nationalism actually works under a strong centralized leader. And also how the regime will deal with such a person. I don't have to tell anybody here that Libya hasn't recovered whatsoever from 2011 under Barack Obama, who certainly had no knowledge or understanding of international politics. Therefore, it came from somewhere else. Most of you know that Libya has been largely split in half. Because it's mostly desert, it's only the extreme northern tip in the Mediterranean that's inhabited. But it was very stable from 1969 to 2011, and prosperous. You have two sides, one in the former capital of Tripoli and the other in Benghazi, but there is no permanent peace. Only Muammar Gaddafi was capable of ruling that country. What put it back in the news very recently is that Russia and the U.S. are both over there. And needless to say, have very different goals and methods of operation. There is, on the one side, the so-called Government of National Unity, which is a U.N.-brokered operation. And on the other, you have the LNA, or the Libyan National Army. Seems that the regime hasn't even come to an agreement internally as to what to do. The GNU is Islamic. The Muslim Brotherhood is a part of this. And these movements, this is when a bit later, when ISIS was fashioned by the West, Western intelligence, and Al-Qaeda used when it's necessary or convenient by the West. None of them are really enemies of the West, at least in how they're used. And the so-called Arab Spring use their infantry whenever needed. And the civil war, both in Libya and Syria, derived from this so-called Arab Spring, of course, is just a media term. Many of you may have noted that Ted Cruz, in a purely symbolic attempt to curry favor with his suburban backers, wanted to outlaw the Muslim Brotherhood in the U.S., because, you know, that's an important issue. And it's been unsuccessful for a whole bunch of reasons, although it has been outlawed in much of the world. But Khalifa Haftar is the field marshal. I didn't even know they had field marshals there. He's the commander of the Libyan National Army. And he is more or less secular and reminds you more of a Assad-type figure. I don't want to connect those two, but those seem to be the two options. He is not, however, very much like the Assad family, is not a partner for the U.S. in Europe. But the Muslim Brotherhood, as well as all of these other groups, have been financed, U.S., U.K., for any of the regime as a whole, not just in North Africa and the Middle East, but also in the Balkans and Central Asia. Not to mention places like the Philippines, Southeast Asia, and Western China. Now, it was the case that your average Libyan benefited from the one thing that Libya has. And of course, we all know what that is. Its energy resources are a huge portion of their income. And it was 2011, airstrikes were used. At the time, it was Sarkozy in France who had an interest in this, and of course Obama, who not just overthrew Gaddafi, who was genuinely popular, but then destroyed most of its infrastructure. And so the Turks, the Egyptians, the Russians, the Americans, British, French, have all stepped in. The Americans, since the overthrow, have been involved in Libya for very obvious reasons. But the U.S. has never been involved in any kind of economic recovery. It's just an attempt to grab up whatever they could. I've argued for years and years and years, the point here is economic. Any country that seems to be on the verge of first world status has to be smashed down to third and fourth world status. That has a lot to do with protecting Israel and protecting American interests, especially when these kind of social nationalist states start doing very well, showing what it could be, and God forbid anybody come to understand that in the Western world. During the American occupation after the overthrow, the tons of gold that had existed in the central bank in Libya suddenly disappeared. And the goons connected to the ridiculous Secretary of State, so-called Hillary Clinton, had stolen the weapons stockpiles, which were shipped from Benghazi to Turkey to be used by Al-Qaeda and the war on Syria. And this really is where so-called ISIS came from, as a way to attack these very same type of leaders wherever they find themselves. You notice that they have no role whatsoever in supporting the Palestinian cause in Lebanon or in the occupied territories, and that's not an accident. So everything that could be stolen was stolen. And you can't get any less popular than the Americans or the British right now in Libya. Gaddafi, on the other hand, ruled a country that was united. It was prosperous. It was drawing labor from all over the Middle East and North Africa. Libyan citizens, including foreigners. You know, it used to be in places like Saudi Arabia and Kuwait, you had Palestinians brought in to do middle and lower level jobs. But even there, they did better than they did anywhere else. But the average Libyan citizen, let's say in 2005 or 2000, had a lifestyle far superior to anyone else in the area. But then freedom and democracy moved in, and now they have nothing, showing what democracy really is. Now, I don't know, I can't say I know that much about Saif Gaddafi, the son of Muammar. I mentioned him before. He has expressed an interest in running for some kind of an office. I doubt he's going to be able to because the U.S., again, I think it was last year I talked about this at some length. They want to send him to the ICC, something to do with, who knows, you know, the ICC and The Hague has no, there's no rules of evidence or anything. It's not a court, and it's like Nuremberg in that sense. But when the war began, if you go back to I have more than one lecture on Gaddafi and his overthrow over the last few years, Gaddafi was very quick and correct to identify his enemies as Al-Qaeda, saying that they're largely a Western creation. The Western media, on the other hand, was being told that they were freedom fighters and grassroots movements to overthrow this awful dictator. Syria alone, in that period of time, had survived the regime's attack on it, never broke up. The army was more or less loyal. And as the U.S. in that war created the Islamic State, Russian intervention proved, and it was actually a brilliant move by Putin and his defense ministry, proved that IS was an American creation, because in intervening in the Syrian civil war and destroying IS positions, the U.S. loudly condemned it. We covered that on Radio Albion years ago when this was going on. I've written about it endlessly. And that was part of the purpose, was to expose the American creation of groups like this, because the U.S. was doing everything in its power to prevent the Russians from destroying their positions, including giving them false coordinates, which the Russians then went public with, saying clearly there's a connection here. And then the U.S. began to condemn over and over again any destruction of ISIS positions. How a group that was formed a couple of days earlier can take what was a first world, or at least a second world military, you know, meaning a Soviet client military, and fight them to a standstill, it has to be artificially created. On the other hand, places like Egypt and Tunisia collapsed. Russia has found it necessary to become involved in the Libyan situation as a counterbalance. And the same thing goes for the Chinese. The economic benefits do not come with any strings. They don't get lectured as to the need for allowing homosexual perversion to rule the state. And at the second Russia-Africa summit in St. Petersburg, that was in July of last year, the council chairman, Mohammed Abmenfi from Libya, referred to this. And he actually appealed to the Russian leadership to help in the withdrawal of all foreign forces from Libyan territory. And 49 African countries showed up in St. Petersburg for that purpose. And he was very clear. He stated, and let me quote him directly. This is the head of the Libyan Presidential Council. Al-Menfi said, concerning the partnership with Russia, "This partnership will be demonstrated in the areas of technology transfer, scientific research, cadre capacity building, energy, and agriculture. The partnership will support efforts of the African group to improve its negotiating position in fields of mining and investments, and to obtain its right to fair and equitable representation on the Security Council. We will be keen to support all efforts for economic integration, what will be agreed with Russia in several fields in an effort to strengthen peace and defuse the present armed conflicts." Now, if you've listened to me in the past, you realize just how significant this comment is. Because the entire purpose here was that having a nationalist leader, centralized, strong, militarized, means that their oil companies are not going to get the kind of deals that they would like. And Russia is the only country really that was aware of this. Now, today, U.S. imports far less than it did prior to the so-called Arab Spring. The goods deficit with Libya from the U.S. was $2 billion in 2022, which is a $40 million increase over 2021. The U.S. sells more to Libya than it buys, so keeping Libya in that permanent state of dependence. The U.S. gave Libya about $50 million in aid in 2022. However, the aid was tied to politics. Liberalism, so-called democracy. It had nothing to do with economic development. In an Islamic country, promoting abortion and the fags is far more significant to those who are donating, usually the private sector, donating money to the Libyans. It had nothing to do with any kind of economic rebuilding at all, since the entire purpose was to destroy it as a possible competitor. Now, One of the reasons I wanted to bring this up, and in terms of the Russian role here, if you remember back in the fall of last year, you had a huge flood in Derna, which led to the deaths. I think the final tally was something like 12,000 people. And that became a bit of a symbol there and now, then and now, for the attack, the 2011 attack on the country. And it's something that the Sergei Lavrov, for example, said at the time is, you know, the West is responsible for this. Now, you don't need the UN report from 2016 that did blame this mass event on the intervention. Of course, I said that at the time. That same report said that there was no reason for this intervention, that the official claims of the regime were, quote, not informed by accurate intelligence. Of course, if you listened to me at the time, you realize you didn't really need a UN report for that. The report also said that the U.S. had drifted into an opportunist policy of regime change, which led to a political and economic collapse, inter-militia and inter-tribal warfare, humanitarian and migrant crises, widespread human rights violations, the spread of weapons across the region, and the growth of ISIL in North Africa. You could imagine my shock as to all of this, since that was the purpose in the first place. Removing Gaddafi meant the destruction of its infrastructure. 13 years now of armed conflict, and no government that functions. So that means when the tropical storm Daniel came through, it unleashed enough rainfall to collapse two dams. But I guess this flooding is part of the democratic restructuring of the country. As I've already mentioned, there's been no attempt to reconstruct, except ideologically speaking, but that doesn't mean much, except possibly in the big cities. You have other, you know, attempts to reconstruct from the Russian and Chinese side, but certainly not from the American side. The mayor of Derna, Al-Galiti, back then said the dams had been completely abandoned due to the conflict that had been raging since that year. And there was never really any, other than the stealing resources, there was never anything else done. The country is conveniently divided into two sides, as I already mentioned, two separate governments. Neither one had any real popularity. But that, too, according to the State Department, is part of the democratic restructuring of North Africa. As I've already mentioned, you have the Government of National Unity in Tripoli, Muslim Brotherhood, etc. But they are backed by the U.S., recognized by the U.N., and of course, the other one, under the Field Marshal. But under the Field Marshal, that was where Derna was. So, after the attacks both on Yugoslavia and Iraq, starting in 99 and then in 2003, all really did the same kind of thing, especially in Iraq, destroying the country. Iraq still lacks whatever it needs after 20 years. It's never recovered, and that, of course, was the point, because it would have been somewhat along the lines of First World, as would Libya have been in Syria. You had something like 20,000 aerial bombardments. And then, making matters worse, you had the flood in Libya and the massive earthquake in Syria and Turkey. The U.S. didn't send a loaf of bread to Latakia, which is one of the hardest hit areas. And the only reason it didn't send anything was because it was under Assad. It was under the central government. I have explained in some depth in the Syrian case that the U.S. Army has scorched farms and food stockpiles, imposing a deliberate starvation policy so as to not benefit Damascus. Rather, U.S. money went to Idlib, which comes under Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, which is allegedly an al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. And its leader, Mohammed al-Dulani, gets treated as a regular statesman and is interviewed on PBS and everything else. So it's hard not to parallel the two examples. But the harsher policy in Syria is only because the central government never fell. The army never split into any kind of politically coherent factions. Now, I mentioned Hillary Clinton's theft of Libyan weapons. And the theft was to send them, as I mentioned, to Turkey and hence Syria to topple the Syrian government. We've been talking about Ukraine, you know, the same kind of extreme levels of corruption. And on the very day that Tripoli fell, the New York Times headline read, "The scramble for access to Libya's oil wealth begins." Libya's oil wealth is the largest in Africa. Now, of course, free for the taking. So the Eastern and Western-based governments use access to these resources as a weapon in their war against each other. But the reality is, the regime's current foreign policy, this responsibility to protect nonsense, given the flood wreckage, which is still, again, there's been no recovery from that either. It was the port city, two dams protecting the city, burst last fall after Tropical Storm Daniel. And, of course, that includes Benghazi, and it was completely destroyed. And what did the regime say? The regime's media said this is proof of the climate crisis. This is the level of understanding that's promoted. Imagine having to say that, given the fact that they're well aware of what caused this. The so-called humanitarian duty to protect nonsense is a direct cause of this. And no real relief efforts can be coordinated since there is no no government to use. They were completely ill-equipped to deal with a catastrophe like this. So Libya today, unlike Syria, is a series of feuding militias, two rival governments, at least two, vying for power without a functional law and a total mismanagement of anything. And there is no way to distribute any of the resources there. And so now you went from almost first world to fourth world. And there is absolutely no attempt. I mean, projecting this onto the climate issue, which is a non-issue, as you all know, just shows you the level of psychological neurosis that the regime has to have. Dysfunctional, chaotic, troubled, unstable, fractured, whatever term you want to use. And for the BBC to refer to Libya as a failed state is laughable, since it wasn't. You had a strong, capable, competent central government under Gaddafi. Free public education, all the way up to the graduate level. Free healthcare. The highest literacy rate. The highest average per capita income in Africa. Verging on first world, as I've said 100 times in the past. Until, of course, the humanitarian intervention. Believe it or not, when the so-called civil war broke out between Gaddafi's forces and the Islamists that the West was financing, and if you've listened to me, they were trained in France, and you know, the French government had back and forth with these leaders to try to overthrow him. I remember, some of you may remember too, the press saying that Gaddafi was arming his soldiers with Viagra so as to encourage mass rape. And you had the neocons and the Republicans buying this crap, feminists yelling about it. And just like all of these stories, nothing ever sinks in. People keep going back to the WMD stuff with Iraq, but these claims are made every day, different countries, different areas. Johnson's Law came out of a lot of this. And when you're a member of the ruling class, you can't learn. So at some level, they have to know that this is all nonsense. The massacre of civilians for no reason, ordered by Gaddafi. Of course, none of this ever happened. David Cameron didn't accept a lot of this. When the British MPs voted to back a war on Libya in March of 2011, Jeremy Corbyn, backbencher, was someone who, a backbencher at the time, who 4 years later was elected Labour opposition leader. And I should say David Cameron was not an opponent of this. I misspoke there. But only 13 dissented entirely. And Jeremy Corbyn was one. David Cameron was lying through his teeth, just like everybody else. And of course, none of this ever happened. As I said at the time, and as I said recently, this was a form of projection, since everything that they were accusing Gaddafi of, they actually, their militias were doing. And it's such a close relation that it has to be primarily a psychological matter. And believe it or not, the British Observer, an editorial, declared an honorable intervention, a hopeful future. A grotesque editorial that they wrote in the Daily Telegraph. David Owen, who was a former British Foreign Secretary, wrote, "We have proved in Libya that intervention can still work." 3 years ago, the Atlantic Council, the neocon, one of the neocon centers, admitted, after all this, Libyans are poor, in greater peril, and experience as much or more political repression in parts of the country compared to Gaddafi's rule. Libya remains divided politically in a state of festering civil war. Frequent oil production halts, while the lack of oil field maintenance has cost the country billions of dollars in lost revenues. At the same time, they're accepting these other nonsensical headlines that we have proved in Libya that intervention can still work. And when the neocons are admitting their miserable failure and yet still touting it for other places, you know that there's a psychological foundation for all of this. And the way that Gaddafi was democratically slaughtered, you didn't need to be me to predict what was going to happen once Gaddafi was gone. That was the point. Slave markets have been reestablished, at least according to people who live there. And this is what happens when a strong central government is removed. Everyone knew that that was going to happen. Of course, that was the point. How many Iraqis are dead because of this? And of course, they want to do the same thing in Tehran. But the earthquake in Syria, the flood later in Libya, is directly the fact that they couldn't possibly resist or respond well to these things. And the flood in Libya derives directly from Western intervention. WikiLeaks, back in 2010, I'm not sure when this was released, but it's from the diplomatic cables in 2010, had a strange relationship with Gaddafi. They initially were trying to mollify him, offering security coordination against the very rebel forces that they were inventing and creating and organizing and training. But of course, that was a lie. Gaddafi was talking about the United States of Africa, at least North Africa, to control the continent's resources. The WikiLeaks cables recounted U.S., French, Spanish, and Canadian oil firms being forced to renegotiate contracts due to Gaddafi's policies. And the Russians and the Chinese were being offered and awarded new exploration options. This is at least part of the reason why the invasion, the attack, was allowed. The journal Declassified UK is actually very, very worthwhile. And it was... And that today, or I should say a few months ago, BP and Shell have returned to Libya's oil fields. And in 2018, I know I've quoted this before, the Britain's then ambassador to Libya, Frank Baker, wrote about how the UK was, quote, helping to create a more permissible environment for trade and investment and uncover opportunities for British expertise to help Libya's reconstruction, which, of course, is a lie. And in one cable from 2008, he's noted to have voiced his satisfaction that Russia's increased strength can serve as a necessary counterbalance to U.S. power, as something that Gaddafi himself and his allies had stated at the time. And this is really what tipped the scales against him in why it was so important for the French and the Americans to overthrow him by backing these rebel forces, these mercenaries. And that culminated not just in the overthrow and slaughter of Gaddafi, but the floods of Derna and the inability to react to the earthquake in Turkey, Syria. But everywhere, Iraq, Syria, Afghanistan, Libya, create a situation where it is sunk into a quagmire of division and instability, and preventing a strong leader, because a strong leader would have to be a social nationalist one to even function. Mark Curtis, back in November of 2022, wrote an article on really the oil issue, and that's a very good publication. And it was back in the fall of that year, Libya's National Oil Corporation agreed for BP to start drilling and producing natural gas in a major project off the coast. Now, that corporation, one of the board members is former MI6 chief John Sawyers. That they now control exploration in areas of Libya, and in this one particular field, about three times the size of Wales. Let me quote Curtis here. BP is one of the few foreign oil and gas companies with exploration and production licenses in Libya. Its assets there were nationalized by Gaddafi soon after he seized power in 1969, a coup that challenged the entire British position in the country and region after years of tensions between the two countries. Prime Minister Tony Blair met Gaddafi in 2004 and agreed to the so-called Deal in the Desert. This included a $900 million exploration and production agreement between BP and Libya's NOC. BP re-entered the country in 2007, but its operations were scuppered by the war of 2011, when British, French, and U.S. forces, with the support of Qatar and Islamic militants, overthrew Gaddafi. Terrorism and civil wars subsequently engulfed the country, and oil company operations were put on hold. Now, I don't know where these licenses are being registered, but there is this seems to be a private sector operation using these two governments in Libya against one another. Now, there was a 2018 memorandum of understanding between the NOC, whoever runs that, and Eni, which is the Italian oil firm, to resume exploration, with Eni acting as the main operator. So who they're working with here, or this is whether this is purely a private sector project. In other words, they have their own security using these one of two governments whenever they need them. And especially in the Sirte Basin, which is about 40,000 square miles. And Shell is also preparing to return as a major player. And another one of the most corrupt, Petrofac. And they provide engineering services to oil operations. And they had, in September of 2022, another $100 million contract to develop the field known as Irawin in the southwest. And they were under investigation at the time for bribery by the UK's Serious Fraud Office. I don't know if they have a minor fraud office, but they have a serious fraud office. And one of its executives, David Lufkin, had already pleaded guilty in 2019 to 11 counts of bribery. I don't know the details there. It really doesn't matter. But that was the month following the award of the Libya contract. Petrofac was again 7 counts of bribery between 2011 and 2017. And they pleaded guilty to its senior executives using agents to bribe officials roughly about £32 million to win contracts in Iraq, Saudi Arabia, and the UAE. And they ended up using a complex set of methods to pay agents across borders, disguising payments through subcontractors and sub-subcontractors, creating fake contracts for fictitious services of all kinds, passing bribes through more than one agent in one country in order to disguise their actions. Petrofac, of course, is closely connected with BP in several countries, in the North Sea, Azerbaijan, Oman, Iraq, and a few other places. So these major firms in Libya have strong links with the UK government, and everything that we're talking about here has to do with them. In some of the years when Petrofac was paying these bribes, the company was led by Ayman Asfari, who with his wife donated almost £1 million to the Conservative Party in 2009-2017. Asfari now is a non-executive director of Petrofac, who a few years ago was appointed by David Cameron to be one of his business ambassadors. And Petrofac itself is incorporated in the tax haven of Jersey, has also benefited from the insurance that the UK taxpayer provides via the UK Export Finance Corporation, which is similar to the Export-Import Bank in Washington, D.C. And this is the context where Frank Baker had in 2018 said that the UK was helping to create this more permissible environment for trade and investment. The new ambassador, Herndahl, or at least ambassador as of a couple of years ago, held meetings with one of the governments, Libya's, in Libya, the oil ambassador, Mohammed Ayoun, to discuss this return of the UK oil companies to Libya. And the NOC, who has set up a hub now in London, the only one outside the of Libya and the US, and, you know, whoever gives them the best deals, who's going to be considered the legitimate government. And the Libyan business, Libyan-British Business Council, who's under Lord Trefgar, one of the ministers under Margaret Thatcher, and under the former ambassador, Peter Millett. And that's the advocacy group that represents both the British state and British corporations to whatever government that they're supporting in North Africa, in Libya. So since there's not going to be any development of Libyan oil wealth without these companies, they now have complete and total control over everything. And it just, and as it turns out, the U.S. doesn't get much of its oil from this part of the world, but Libya was the U.K.'s third largest source after Norway and the U.S., so it's almost 10% of British oil imports come from Libya. That's why the British and the French have been more involved in this than the U.S. So the U.K., all of this is being done, as I mentioned, by the Government of National Unity in Tripoli, despite the fact that the eastern part of the country is under its rival government, Haftar, I should say. But the U.K. is backing the Government of National Unity. So that's where we are. And this is, nothing has changed. This is the exact same thing. This was the point of the attack. This is why it was very important to get rid of Gaddafi. This is what the Arab Spring was all about. And these are just the complexes of extremely economically based concerns that the regime has in getting rid of certain people, and why people like Gaddafi were so important. And we appreciate him more and more as the years go on, when we see exactly who his enemies truly were. Anyway, I've gone way over my time here. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Albion, talk radio for the nationalist community.